For a whole year, the roving vehicles were as likely to bring sudden death as arrest or aid. At unpredictable intervals, always at night, rifles would fire, and a truck would roar in and swoop and maneuver until one lone runner was winnowed out from the pack. Then the lone runner would be hunted for a mile or so, and shot down. Then the truck would disappear into the dark again, engine roaring, headlights bouncing, dust trailing, and stunned silence would descend. Sometimes it wasn't so clean. Some victims were wounded and dragged away and tortured. The corpse of one teenage boy was found tied to a cactus stump with barbed wire. He had been partially flayed. Some were burned alive, or beheaded, or mutilated. Three teenage girls were captured over a period of 4 months. Their autopsy details were gruesome. None of the survivor families made official complaints. They all shared the illegals' basic fear of involvement with bureaucracy. But stories began to circulate around the community of legal relatives and their support groups. Lawyers and rights advocates started compiling files. Eventually, the subject was broached at the appropriate level. A low-level inquiry was started. Evidence was gathered anonymously. A provable total of 17 homicides was established. Added to that was an extrapolated figure of 8 more to represent cases where bodies had never been found or where they had been buried by the survivors themselves. Young Raul Garcia's name was included in the second total. There was a map in the file. Most of the ambushes had taken place inside a pear-shaped pocket of territory, enclosing maybe 100 square miles. It was marked on the map like a stain. It was centered on a long north-south axis, with the southerly bulge sitting mostly inside the Echo County line. That meant the victims had already made it 50 miles or more. By then, they would be weak and tired and in no shape to resist. Border Patrol brass launched a full-scale investigation one August, 11 months after the first vague rumors surfaced. There was one more attack at the end of that month, and then nothing ever again. Denied an ongoing forensic basis for examination, the investigation got nowhere at all. There were preventive measures enforced, like strict accounting of ammunition and increased frequency of radio checks, but no conclusions were reached. It was a thorough job, and to their credit, the brass kept hard at it. But a retrospective investigation into a closed paramilitary world where the only witnesses denied ever having been near the border in the first place was hopeless. The matter wound down. Time passed. The homicides had stopped. The survivors were building new lives. The immigration amnesties had insulated the outrage. The tempo of investigation slowed to a halt. The files were sealed 4 years later.
"So?"
Alice said. Reacher butted the papers together with the heel of his hand, closed the file, pitched it behind him into the rear seat. "Now I know why she lied about the ring," he said.
"Why?"
"She didn't lie. She was telling the truth."
"She said it was a fake worth $30.
"And she thought that was the truth, because some jeweler in Pecos laughed at her and told her it was a fake worth $30, and she believed him. But he was trying to rip her off, was all. Trying to buy it for $30 and sell it again for $60,000. Oldest scam in the world. Exact same thing happened to some of these immigrants in the file. Their first experience of America."
"The jeweler lied?"
He nodded. "I should have figured it before, because it's obvious. Probably the exact same guy we went to. I figured he didn't look like the Better Business Bureau's poster boy."
"He didn't try to rip us off?"
"No, Alice, he didn't. Because you're a sharp-looking white lawyer, and I'm a big, tough-looking white guy. She was a small Mexican woman, all alone and desperate and scared. He saw an opportunity with her that he didn't see with us." Alice was quiet for a second.
"So what does it mean?"
Reacher clicked off the dome light, smiled in the dark and stretched, put his palms on the dash in front of him and flexed his massive shoulders against the pressure. "It means we're good to go," he said. "It means all our ducks are in a neat little row, and it means you should drive faster, because right now we're maybe 20 minutes ahead of the bad guys, and I want to keep it that way as long as I can." She blew straight through the sleeping crossroads hamlet once again and made the remaining 60 miles in 43 minutes, which Reacher figured was pretty good for a yellow four-cylinder import with a bud vase next to the steering wheel. She made the turn in under the gate and braked hard and stopped at the foot of the porch steps. The porch lights were on, and the VW's dust fogged up around them in a khaki cloud. It was close to 2 o'clock in the morning. "Leave it running," Reacher said. He led her up to the door, hammered hard on it, and got no reply. Tried the handle. It was unlocked. Why would it be locked? We're 60 miles from the nearest crossroads. He swung it open, and they stepped straight into the red-painted foyer. "Hold your arms out," he said. He unloaded all 6.22 hunting rifles out of the rack on the wall and laid them in her arms, alternately muzzle to stock so they would balance. She staggered slightly under the weight. "Go put them in the car," he said. There was the sound of footsteps overhead, then creaking from the stairs, and Bobby Greer came out of the parlor door, rubbing sleep out of his eyes. He was barefoot and wearing boxers and a T-shirt and staring at the empty gun rack. "Hell you think you're doing?" he said. "I want the others," Reacher said. "I'm commandeering your weapons on behalf of the Echo County Sheriff. I'm a deputy, remember?" "There aren't any others." "Yes, there are, Bobby. No self-respecting redneck like you is going to be satisfied with a bunch of 22 pop guns. Where's the heavy metal?" Bobby said nothing. "Don't mess with me, Bobby. It's way too late for that." Bobby paused, then he shrugged. "Okay." He padded barefoot across the foyer and pushed open a door that led into a small, dark space that could have been a study. He flicked on a light, and Reacher saw black and white pictures of oil wells on the walls. There was a desk and a chair and another gun rack filled with 4.30-30 Winchesters. 7-shot lever-action repeaters, big, handsome weapons, oiled wood, 20-inch barrels beautifully kept. "Wyatt Earp, eat your heart out." "Ammunition?" Reacher asked. Bobby opened a drawer in the gun rack's pedestal, took out a cardboard box of Winchester cartridges. "I got some special loads, too," he said. Took out another box. "What are they?" "I made them myself. Extra power." Reacher nodded. "Take them all out to the car, okay?" He took the 4 rifles out of the rack and followed Bobby out of the house. Alice was sitting in the car. The 6.22s were piled on the seat behind her. Bobby leaned in and placed the ammunition next to them. Reacher stacked the Winchesters upright behind the passenger seat. Then he turned back to Bobby. "I'm going to borrow your Jeep," he said. Bobby shrugged, barefoot on the hot dirt. "Keys are in it," he said. "You and your mother stay in the house now," Reacher said. "Anybody seen out and about will be considered hostile, okay?" Bobby nodded, turned and walked to the foot of the steps, glanced back once and went inside the house. Reacher leaned into the VW to talk to Alice.
"What are we doing?"
"Getting ready."
"For what?"
"For whatever comes our way."
"Why do we need 10 rifles?
"We don't. We need one. I don't want to give the bad guys the other 9 is all.
"They're coming here?"
"They're about 10 minutes behind us."
"So what do we do?"
"We're all going out in the desert."
"Is there going to be shooting?"
"Probably."
"Is that smart? You said yourself they're good shots."
"With handguns. Best way to defend against handguns is hide a long way off and shoot back with the biggest rifle you can find." She shook her head.
I can't be a part of this, Richard. It's not right. And I've never even held a rifle."
"You don't have to shoot, but you have to be a witness. You have to identify exactly who comes for us. I'm relying on you. It's vital."
"How will I see? It's dark out there."
"We'll fix that."
"It's going to rain."
"That'll help us."
"This is not right. The police should handle this. Or the FBI. You can't just shoot at people."
The air was heavy with storm. The breeze was blowing again, and he could smell pressure and voltage building in the sky. "Rules of engagement, Alice. I'll wait for an overtly hostile act before I do anything. Just like the U.S. Army, okay?"
"We'll be killed."
"You'll be hiding, far away."
"Then you'll be killed. You said it yourself, they're good at this."
"They're good at walking up to somebody and shooting them in the head. What they're like out in the open, in the dark, against incoming rifle fire, is anybody's guess."
"You're crazy."
7 minutes, he said. She glanced backward at the road from the north. Then she shook her head and shoved the gear stick in first and held her foot on the clutch. He leaned in and squeezed her shoulder. "Follow me close, okay?" he said. He ran down to the motor barn and got into the Greer family's Cherokee, racked the seat back, and started the engine and switched on the headlights, reversed into the yard and straightened up and looped around the motor barn and headed straight down the dirt track into open country. Checked the mirror and saw the VW right there behind him. Looked ahead again and saw the first raindrop hit his windshield. It was as big as a silver dollar. 16. They drove in convoy for 5 fast miles through the dark. There was no moonlight, no starlight. Cloud cover was low and thick, but it held the rain to nothing more than occasional splattering drops, 10 whole seconds between each of them, maybe 6 in every minute. They exploded against the windshield into wet patches the size of saucers. Reacher swatted each of them separately with the windshield wipers. He held steady around 40 miles an hour and followed the track through the brush. It turned randomly left and right, heading basically south toward the storm. The ground was very rough. The Jeep was bouncing and jarring. The VW was struggling to keep pace behind him. Its headlights were swinging and jumping in his mirrors. 5 miles from the house, the rain was still holding, and the mesquite and the fractured limestone began to narrow the track. The terrain was changing under their wheels. They had started out across a broad desert plain that might have been cultivated grassland a century ago. Now the ground was rising slowly and shading into mesa. Rocky outcrops rose left and right in the headlight beams, channeling them roughly south and east. Taller stands of mesquite crowded in and funneled them tighter. Soon, there was nothing more than a pair of deep ruts worn through the hard pan. Ledges and sinkholes and dense patches of thorny low brush meant they had no choice but to follow them. They curved and twisted and felt like a riverbed. Then the track bumped upward and straightened and ran like a highway across a miniature limestone mesa. The stone was a raised pan as big as a football field, maybe 120 yards long and 80 wide, roughly oval in shape. There was no vegetation growing on it. Reacher swung the Jeep in a wide circle and used the headlights on bright to check the perimeter. All around the edges, the ground fell away a couple of feet into rocky soil. Stunted bushes crowded any place they could find to put their roots. He drove a second circle, wider, and he liked what he saw. The miniature mesa was as bare as a dinner plate laid on a dead lawn. He smiled to himself, timed out in his head what they needed to do, like the answer he came up with. He drove all the way to the far end of the rock table and stopped where the track bumped down off it and disappeared onward. Alice pulled the VW alongside him. He jumped out of the Jeep and ducked down to her window. The night air was still hot, still damp. The urgent breeze was back. Big raindrops fell lazily and vertically. He felt like he could have dodged each of them individually. Alice used a switch and buzzed the window down. "You okay?" he asked her.
"So far."
"Turn it around and back it up to the edge. All the way back, block the mouth of the track." She maneuvered the car like she was parking on a city street and ran it backward until it was centered in the mouth of the track and the rear wheels were tight against the drop. She left the front facing exactly north, the way they had come. He nosed the Jeep next to her and opened the tailgate. "Kill the motor and the lights," he called. "Get the rifles." She passed him the big Winchesters one at a time. He laid them sideways in the Jeep's load space. She passed him the .22s, and he pitched them away into the brush as far as he could throw them. She passed him the 2 boxes of .30-30 ammunition, Winchester's own and Bobby Greer's hand loads. He laid them alongside the rifles, ducked around at the driver's door and switched the engine off. The lumpy 6-cylinder idle died. Silence fell. He listened hard and scanned the northern horizon. The mesquite sighed faintly in the wind. Unseen insects buzzed and chattered. Infrequent raindrops hit his shoulders. That was all. Nothing else. Absolute blackness and silence everywhere. He came back to the tailgate and opened the ammunition boxes. They were both packed tight with cartridges standing on their firing pins, points upward. The factory shells were new and bright. Bobby's were a little scuffed, recycled brass. He took one out and held it up to the Jeep's interior light and looked hard at it. "I made them myself," Bobby had said. "Extra power." Which was logical. Why else would a jerk like Bobby hand load his own cartridges? Not for less power, that was for sure. Like, why do people tune hot rod motors? Not to make them milder than stock. It's a boy thing. So Bobby had probably packed and tamped a whole lot of extra powder into each one. Maybe 30 or 40 extra grains. And maybe he had used hotter powder than normal. which would give him a couple hundred extra foot-pounds of muzzle energy, and maybe 100 miles an hour extra velocity, and which would give him the muzzle flash from hell, and which would ruin his breech castings and warp his barrels inside a couple of weeks. But Reacher smiled and took 10 more of the shells out of the box anyway. They weren't his guns, and he had just decided muzzle flash was exactly what he was looking for. He loaded the first Winchester with a single sample of Bobby's handloads. The second he filled with 7 more. The third he loaded alternately, one stock round, one of Bobby's, another stock round, until it was full with 4 stock and 3 handloads. The fourth rifle he filled entirely with factory ammo. He laid the guns left to right in sequence across the Jeep's load space and closed the tailgate on them.
"I thought we only needed one," Alice said.
"I changed the plan." He stepped around to the driver's seat and Alice climbed in beside him.
"Where are we going now?"
she asked. He started the engine and backed away from the parked VW. "Think of this mesa like a clock face," he said. "We came in at the 6 o'clock position. Right now, your car is parked at the 12, facing backward. You're going to be hiding on the rim at the 8, on foot. Your job is to fire a rifle, one shot, and then scoot down to the 7.